It is my other world, and I appreciate, I love gospel music. I appreciate, I love Chicago, and this book covers both. A City Called Heaven, Chicago, and the Birth of Gospel Music. Bob Maravich is the author. Bob is an old friend of mine. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Now, you are totally into gospel music, so much so, by the way, this book covers everything. I mean, everything. We're talking about 450 pages. Yeah. This is a huge book with citations. It could be a textbook, but yet it's an interesting read, and we'll get there. But I want to start here. Mm-hmm. How did a white guy like you, and you must get this all the time, get into gospel music to the extent that you are one of our nation's experts on the topic?
Well, it started really, I think, when I was about 5 years old, indirectly.
What? Really?
I think so, yeah. When I was five and my friends were buying records by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, I was sort of out buying records by Booker T and the MGs for no other reason than I liked it.
It's green onions
and Hang 'em High and Soul Clap.
I remember those things. Yeah.
So I was always interested in African-American music. And then as I got older, I would listen to blues and R&B and vocal harmony. So I liked all those 50s vocal groups. But it wasn't until 1984, and I was in college, that I heard gospel for the first time.
Real gospel.
I was in my dorm room switching around the radio channels and found a live broadcast from the Cosmopolitan Church of Prayer Choir in Chicago on the South Side. And it blew me away. It sort of made me realize for the first time, here's this music that I love tied with religion. And all I could think of is, I wish our church sounded that good. I want to go to that church.
Well, what is it about gospel music that blew you away? Now, there's the power of the music, and maybe your terms are exactly right. Blow you away, because there's the physical power. Mm-hmm. I mean, these gospel singers can sing.
Yes.
I mean,
they
blow out the church, as they say. But also there's the emotional power.
Yeah, and I think it really was the emotional power that caught me. I was a music minister for our dorms.
What's that?
Okay, a music minister is somebody who kind of takes over the music for the service. So at the University of Notre Dame, where I was attending, each one of our dorms had a chapel. And we had 11 p.m. chapel, and I was in charge of the music. But we were singing songs that, you know, were the folk rock of the Catholic Church was in the folk rock at that point. So here I hear a group that has so much emotion, so much passion. They're taking what are essentially spirituals and putting them on hyperdrive. And the energy was so much so that it extended beyond the song. The song was over, and the energy was still there. And I could feel like the presence of the worship service. And I really thought, this is exactly how it ought to be. This is the kind of feeling you should get when you sing religious music. And I was smart enough to put a tape recording, a cassette in the tape recorder. It was one of those old day where you had the tape recorder and the radio and phonograph. I started taping the broadcast, and I would play that broadcast over and over and over. And of course, years later, I had the honor to know Dr. Charles G. Hayes and the Cosmopolitan Church of Prayer Choir, the choir masters there and the singers. But that was where it all started, in January of 1984.
So there's so much that you cover in the book. I mean, it really is quite a history of gospel music in Chicago, and I want to touch on some highlights for me for when I read your book. But let me go back to Chicago. You call it a city called heaven. Can you explain what that is, what that's all about?
Sure. It actually comes from an old spiritual. I am a poor pilgrim of sorrow, trying to make heaven my home. And this was a song that Mahalia Jackson sung. Many, many artists sang the song.
I am a poor pilgrim of sorrow. I'm tossed in this wide world alone. No.
Sometimes I'm tossed.
the idea was that it linked in with the Great Migration, which plays a major role in this book and in the history of gospel music in Chicago. So here were the migrants, the African-American migrants, coming from the South to the North, looking for a freedom from the Jim Crow segregation of the South, but also looking for freedom to better their condition, better jobs. And sort of they saw the North and they saw Chicago as the promised land, the city called heaven, where all of our troubles will be taken care of. Of course, it wasn't that case when they got here, but that was the image in their minds.
Well, how close was it to the case or not? I mean, was it better than living in Alabama or Arkansas or wherever in the South?
Yes, it was. I mean, in fact, there was one person who wrote back to his family and said, sure, there are things that aren't great, but never mind them. It's so much better than where we're coming from. Because in the South, of course, you had so much insidious racism where you feared for your life. If, as we know about the Emmett Till situation in 1955, if you whistled or you winked at a white woman and you were a black male, you could be killed. Now, in Chicago, it wasn't like that. You could actually sit on the streetcar next to a white person. You could walk down the street as a black person and not have to get off that side of the sidewalk because a white person was walking by. But there was a more cunning sort of segregation here in Chicago. So when African Americans came to here, they could only live in certain places. They were not allowed to live elsewhere. There were what they call restrictive covenants, where real estate agents would say you can't live beyond a certain level. So
Are we seeing the effects of that still even today?
Absolutely.
I mean, Chicago is still a very segregated, I think. I mean, maybe I'm mistaken, but I think compared to New York or Los Angeles or Houston, which are the comparable cities as far as size goes, Chicago, the good news, the city of neighborhoods, the bad news, if you feel it's bad news, and I have mixed feelings about this in some way, but it's a segregated city.
Yeah, and it's gotten better, but it certainly back then it was, and it really created a situation where the African Americans, well, they're poor, coming from the South, didn't have much, got jobs that didn't pay much.
So was it economic or was it racist?
It was both. There was certainly an economic aspect of it where if you didn't have much money, here's where you had to live. But if you had the money, and there are gospel artists such as Roberta Martin, whose father was well-to-do, I mean, in the sense of in Arkansas, he owned a farm, he had a store, so he could have, but if he wanted to move into then Englewood or Lawndale, that would not have been, he would have been dissuaded. In fact, when Mahalia Jackson moved to 84th in Indiana, somebody shot a bullet hole through her window. They did not want black people in their area. So you had
And it
that.
Didn't matter that it was Mahalia Jackson.
No, it didn't.
And I want to talk about, so for people who don't know, her level of fame nationally, I don't know who you'd compare it to today because it is niche music, and it was then. And unlike today, there was no internet to see everything, of course. So, you know, there were people that didn't know, but she was famous, as famous as you could be, even at sort of early on in her career, through the height of her career. By the time she passed away, this was like a state funeral in Chicago, wasn't it?
It was.
You're right about that.
Yeah, she, in fact, they had to have two funerals because the one at her church at Greater Salem, it was too small and too many people couldn't get in. So Mayor Daley at the time organized.
First
mayor.
Yeah.
He organized the Erie Crown Theater to be used for her service, and Aretha Franklin sang, and Thomas A. Dorsey, the father of gospel music, was there.
Now this I don't remember how many people the amphitheater held. I was there lots of times. I think that there was a hockey team that actually played there for a short time at one time. That's what I went there for.
Right.
But it held thousands and thousands of people. I mean, I don't know, 15, 20,000 people or more.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of people for a funeral.
Yeah, she was the international ambassador of gospel music by that time. She signed with Columbia Records in 1954, and they had her to do television, radio. She went overseas. She sang. If anyone did not know anything about gospel, they knew Mahalia Jackson's name. And in fact, it's still true today. I suppose if you ask somebody who really isn't up on gospel, who would you know as a name? They would remember Mahalia Jackson because she just transcended cultures and ethnic groups and everything.
The mountain, give me strength to
So here's this. I think it was her that you said this happened to. I don't remember where it happened. It was somewhere in the South. She was just driving along, and she got into big trouble. I don't remember what it was, but she shouldn't. You remember the story?
Yeah,
you
tell
the story.
Yeah, she was driving from Chicago to New Orleans, where she grew up, and she was heading back home. She was in her Cadillac.
Minding her own business,
late night, driving through Mississippi, and she got pulled over.
But she was in a Cadillac.
She was, and that was something that the police in the South during the Jim Crow era did not like. They just assumed if you were a black person in a Cadillac, you stole it. And they pulled her off to the side, and she had to empty out her wallet. She had to empty out everything. They frisked her. The good thing about Mahalia, she kept money in places where they wouldn't have looked. So she got away.
How do you know that? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
What kind of research did you do?
Right. No, she actually, there's a wonderful biography by Lorraine Goreau, who was sort of a good friend of hers, was a journalist in New Orleans. And she told some pretty honest stories about Mahalia. Mahalia did not mess around. But there was an instance where she was pulled over, cited for, I think, something minor, some infraction, a speeding or something. But it was just there to hassle her because they just thought, who is this woman driving a Cadillac? You know, she must have stolen it from her employer.
But she did not spend a night in jail?
She did not, although she did spend a night in jail. It's not actually in the book, but she did early on her career. Mahalia Jackson was fierce about business. You paid her up front, and you paid her what you were supposed to pay her, or she wouldn't sing. And she got into a confrontation with a promoter who did not pay her what he was supposed to, and she refused to sing, and she walked off, and he got mad, and he called the police and said she walked out on her contract, and she spent a couple hours in prison until they got her out. But she was fierce. She wouldn't perform if you didn't pay her.
I want to talk about gospel music itself a little bit. It's more than just about religion, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's really a music of hope and encouragement. I believe that a music really is a reflection of the culture with which it is birthed. And gospel music is a statement of freedom. So whether it's an internal freedom or it's an external freedom.
What do you mean by that?
So in some instances, the songs were literally saying things like, there are places I can't go, but I know God is real, and he's real in my soul. And so there were sometimes these messages about the freedom that you didn't have as a human being in American society. But then there was also just the sense of if you had your own troubles, whether it was poverty, unemployment, whether it was somebody in your home was sick, you were sick, these kinds of things, that you could sing your troubles over through the songs. And you hear a lot of stories about people who said they grew up listening to their mother sing, and it was a way to express your sorrows, your joys, your happiness in ways that other music didn't do. Blues, you would sing it, but when you were done, you're kind of still blue. You didn't solve the problem. But in gospel,
I like that.
But in gospel, you could sort of work through your problems and at least know that there is a potentially a happier day in the future on earth or after in the city called heaven.
Oh, happy day. Yeah. You mentioned a happier day. That was one of the first big gospel pop records. It was 1967 or 8. Mm-hmm. Edwin Hawkins, I think. Yeah. I remember playing that on at an oldie station. I wasn't old enough myself. But I remember playing it. Yeah. And I can hear the song in my head even today. Gospel music was never, even Mahalia Jackson wasn't on pop radio stations.
That's correct.
I think that was the first one. Is that one of the sort of places where gospel music, like all kinds of music, changes, it evolves, where, okay, this is a change.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. It was a major change that we still feel today. It was also a change in the locus of where gospel was. So it kind of moved from Chicago to California after the Hawkins family from, the Bay Area brought Oh Happy Day. It's always, gospel music has always changed because of the youth. And in the late 60s, people like Edwin Hawkins, Walter Hawkins, Andre Crouch, they wanted the gospel that they sang to have the elements of music that they liked, the rock, the folk, the soul, the jazz, and they created that.
Oh, happy day.
That's where we got O Happy Day. So this is a combination of new styles of music that represented that particular generation. And so they just infused it with spiritual lyrics and moved it on.
Al Green is another. So here's a guy that had all these hit records. I mean, we could name 15 hits that hit the top 15 from Al Green. Let's Stay Together, I think, is the most well-known from 1973 or 74. But he had many of them. And then he said at some point in his career, well, I'm going to be a gospel singer instead. And he took some of that pop also into the world of gospel music.
Yeah. And he is an example, one example of many, where they grew up in the church, they went to the secular side, and then for some reason or other, either it was a calling, and in Al Green's case, I think it was he was called to be a preacher.
Yeah.
Kind of tossed it all to the side. There was a gentleman named Gatemouth Brown who was here in Chicago, Reverend Gatemouth Moore, rather, and he was singing on the stage of the Club DeLisa one night and just got the calling, I need to be singing spiritual, and he ran off the stage and he went and became a minister.
Wow. So Chicago evolved, and Chicago's music evolved over the years, too. Where are we now? Is it still like... When you begin this book, Chicago was at the top of the hill.
Yeah, yeah.
When you thought of gospel music, you thought of, in great part, Chicago.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that still true or not?
Part of it is true. If you look at the Billboard charts and you look at who gets nominated for the Stellars, which is sort of the gospel version of the Grammys.
Sure.
There are several Chicago artists on there. So Anita Wilson is one. Pastor Jenkins and Fellowship Chicago, Vishawn Mitchell. There are Jonathan McReynolds, who came from just the western suburbs. You have that element of it, but it's now diffused. The music is now as much in Nashville as in Atlanta, as in Houston, as in Dallas, as in California. And so it's become much more of a – there's not a single hub as there used to be. Back in the day, you're right, I mean, it was Chicago. And in fact, when European choirs come over to learn about gospel – in the homeland, they always consider Chicago to be the place they come for this sound. So in terms of contemporary gospel, there are many locuses in the country, but you still get in Chicago. You can still go to a church on a Sunday, particularly a smaller church, and hear the gospel music that we talk about in the book, that kind of passionate, down home, you know, I call it clap and stomp kind of gospel music that was here for years and years and years.
The other thing about gospel music, so rock and roll music, I believe its roots are from the blues, and over the years has gotten angry at times, depending on the performer. That began in the 60s. I'm not sure Elvis was, but at times very angry and at times very social. You know, it has to do with what's going on in our world, and it's sort of a commentary on that. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's probably a good thing. Gospel music seems to never have gone that route. Am I right about that or not so much?
It did in the 60s.
Like everything else?
Like everything else. Yeah. It and that is, it's always been a big question, because they said, well, how come gospel music didn't start out really with these messages of protest? And I think because a lot of the artists knew that if they sang these protest songs, they would not be played on the radio. But it started to change in the early 60s when the civil rights movement got its momentum. And you started to hear people like The Impressions singing, you know, Keep On Pushing. And suddenly you hear a change. And it happened here in Chicago. As a matter of fact, the Lehner brothers, who owned a series of labels, including one called Halo, which was just for gospel, they recorded a lot of these artists. And at that time, you hear the change. You hear it going into music that starts to talk about, we need a better day today. Society, you know, they had a song called We Must Love Our Fellow Man. There was a song called The Children Going Astray by the Salem Travelers, which was a big hit out of Chicago, that stopped just being very, very religious, but started to take a social message. And so that carried through. And then after the assassination of Dr. King, there were a whole slew of songs that came out saying either, either sad about his passing or saying, and most of them saying, we've got to take his message and keep it going. And so within the religious community, you had these very soulful, very powerful songs suggesting that we've got, it's our turn to do something now to make things better.
It seems in the world of gospel music, and maybe it's just my mistaken impression, well, there are new songs coming out all the time, and you point in the 60s, this era, but those songs didn't hold up. And there are certain classics. So, yes, there are rock and roll classics that are sung all the time, but really not like gospel music. Those classics are considered, it's like the classical Irving Berlin stuff, if you will, except nobody sings that stuff right anymore. In church, everyone sings, really, those classics still.
Yeah. You hit on a good point, Steve, that the earliest songs tend to be the favorites in church. So if you go to a funeral.
But when those songs were first created, the performers are dead. The people mm-hmm. who remember them are long dead. Yeah. And other generations now have said, oh, well, these are our songs.
Yeah. So like Precious Lord, Take My Hand, you'll still hear sung as a classic. Yes, God Is Real, Peace in the Valley. But yes, with every new generation, there are new songs. Right now in gospel is this style called praise and worship.
What is that?
This is a very kind of a blend of gospel technique with the contemporary Christian music sound. And it was really designed for the mega churches that were multicultural so that everyone felt like this was our music. And I think it draws its roots also from the Edwin Hawkins and Andre Crouch, who sort of paved the way for some of this. But it's very repetitive. It's really simple melodies, simple lyrics, easy to sing. You sing along. And it has created a divide. There are some who say, I love praise and worship, and the traditionalists who say, I don't understand praise and worship. They call it 7-11 music. Seven words sung 11 times in a row. But there are beautiful melodies. And with my work with the Journal of Gospel Music, I want to make sure my favorite is traditional. But when I hear good praise and worship, I have to comment on it. There are some wonderful composers writing in that style. But it's different. It's really different from gospel music. You're not going to hear that shouting lead singer. You're not going to hear what they call the praise break sound, where all of the musicians pick up the tempo and play for several minutes in a very heavy, fast tempo. That's not. It's more of a mellower sound.
What is the most emotional experience? And this is not in the book. What is the most, or if it is, I didn't see it. For you personally, the most emotional moment and going around to churches and other venues where you've heard gospel singers now probably thousands of times in your life that you've had.
Wow, there's been many, actually. And I think the times that it's happened, I would say probably the one time that I can remember the most was being at it's called the Gospel Supreme. Reverend Macia Woods puts it on every year. It's a special program that's held at First Church of Deliverance on the South Side. Mm-hmm. And they were honoring some of the pioneers and legends that were still with us. And the music rose and people were singing, and the song that they were singing, suddenly it ended, but it didn't end, and people were shouting in the aisles, and people were running around the church, and people were getting the Holy Ghost, which is where you start to dance and sort of thing, and the music picked up with it. And you just sort of felt a communion in that room of people just all at one in the moment. And I thought that was amazing, because I thought, in my growing up, in my upbringing in the Catholic Church, everything was very liturgical. You did this, then you did that, then you did that. Here it was so open and just let the Spirit go that for minutes people just had a great experience in worship. And I just sat there and thought, this is the way it should be. This is really the way it should be.
Well, the other thing about the way it should be, so how many people were in that room? A few thousand maybe?
Oh, no, in this instance, there's probably maybe 500.
Okay.
Yeah.
500 people. Were you the only middle-aged white guy there?
Maybe one or two others, yeah.
Yeah, but that is the way it should be, too, I think. And most people think, but it isn't the way it is.
Right.
Where race doesn't matter. It's all about the experience that you're there for.
And I started, when I first started in gospel radio here in Chicago, I would go to we have a Gospel Announcers Guild, which is association of gospel announcers on the various radio stations and artists and promoters. And I think building up a base of trust there, that they welcomed me. Here I was, this Caucasian guy coming in with the Gospel Oldies program. And from there, just starting to meet people and to start to learn the culture and what was appropriate and what was inappropriate. And suddenly all of the things that I thought might have divided us were not divisive at all. To the point now where people will say, wow, do you feel strange going into a church where you're the only white person? And it occurred to me, I didn't even think about that when I walked in. I just walked in.
Yeah,
it never occurred to me. But
had you ever been treated oddly or differently or even concerned in some neighborhoods just because of the neighborhood about your safety?
I probably should be more concerned than I am.
Or maybe that's a racist question.
No. There are times when I think people, because I mean, I've gone to churches where people watch everyone's car when they're in church to make sure nothing happens. And, you know, you hear about things you hear about random shootings and things that happen near where you're at churches. After all these years, I sort of go fearlessly wherever. I've never been treated badly. It's always been welcoming. And I always tell other white folk that are going to go to church in a black community, I said, be prepared, because you may be the only white person in the service, you will be asked to stand and say who you are. And it's in a friendly, welcoming kind of way. And I said, but don't be surprised if they ask you to stand up and say a little bit about you. Don't be surprised so you're not embarrassed. And that's typically the case. If I'll go, now that they know who I am, they might ask me to stand up for that. But even before anyone knew who I was, they would ask who you are and why you're here. And they would be very welcoming and maybe even give you a little go-away package with some stuff in it. So yeah, it's always been a very welcoming community. And that is really, I think, how I could write this book, because I had people who knew who I was. So they trusted that I wasn't trying to take a story that was theirs and become a millionaire selling the story. It was really about telling a story, because as Toni Morrison, the author, says, if you want to read a book that hasn't been written, why don't you write it? And so that's what I did.
Yeah, well, yeah, I understand that.
But I don't know that I could have done it in that depth had I not had the support of the Chicago Gospel community, the Gospel Announcers Guild.
Well, wow. Yeah. I mean, speaking of depth, I mean, this book is incredible. I mean, when I introduced you, I said this could be a textbook, and that's darn right. I mean, there are, I don't know how many hundreds of references in here, a detailed index. I mean, this could be a textbook.
Yeah. In fact, there's a gentleman named James Roberson, who's a record company owner on the West Coast. He also teaches, I think, at UCLA. I think he'd like to make this a text. I think it's great for African American studies. It's great for religious studies. There are very few gospel music history programs around the country. I think there's one at Valparaiso University. So in those instances, it would work well, because this is the history of gospel music, Chicago, but in general, it's the history because we started here. So even if you wanted to say, well, we don't really care about Chicago, we just want to know about gospel, it's still the same story. It just so happens that it's a Chicago-born music. So it hasn't, to my knowledge, it hasn't taken off as a text yet, but it certainly could be. And my goal was to do a book that was academic in format, so that it got the university approval and sort of a sense of academic
It is,
imprimatur.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's an easy read.
That's what I wanted. I didn't want somebody to have to buy two books, mine and a dictionary.
Do they even make dictionaries anymore?
Well, probably not.
Who is the greatest gospel singer from here, Chicago, that you've ever heard?
Well, I think it would have to be Mahalia Jackson.
Did you hear her in person?
I never heard her in person. In terms of in person, I have
on. I'll get to in person in a second, but now I want to know, why Mahalia Jackson?
She has a way of getting into your soul that no other artist that I've ever heard does. I mean, there are other more passionate, more emotional musicians and artists out there than Mahalia. But what she has seems to just resonate. And I've seen it time and again where I'll play something by Mahalia and you'll think, oh, people are going to think that's old, way old fashioned. And yet people just walk away kind of feeling emotionally drained after hearing her.
Really?
So I think she was one of those once in a century type voices.
And the one you've heard in person?
I would have to say it's the Cosmopolitan Church of Prayer Choir. The one that started me off, every time I hear them, they just have a sonority that just lifts everything. They sing in the old-time way. Even though they're still out there all these years later, they still sing traditional gospel. And they do it in such a way that you can't help but feel uplifted when you're done. So they, to this day, remain my favorite.
So we talked about the various ways and sort of the turns in the road gospel music has made. To me, though, when I think of gospel music, I do think you used the term several times in this conversation, uplifting.
Yes.
At the end of the day, is it still that?
It is. I think even if you don't like certain genres of gospel, it can be uplifting because of the message. It's really about the message. So if you listen to old traditional song, it's about getting over and surviving the day. That's helpful. Even if it's just kind of a meditative praise song, it might hit something in you that resonates.
And do you have a favorite song that touches you?
Yeah, you know, Take My Hand, Precious Lord. To this day, has always been a song that when I hear it or if I sing it, it just has a. It's I felt it's like that's a song that allows people to grieve if they're feeling really low. There's no better song to sort of that catharsis to grieve than "Take My Hand, Precious Lord."
Well, when it comes to gospel music, there probably is no better book. "A City Called Heaven: Chicago and the Birth of Gospel Music." People can get the book anywhere?
They certainly can. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookstores everywhere.
All right. If you can find a bookstore, but right. Amazon works. Robert Merovitz, author of this book, all about Chicago and the birth of gospel music. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.